and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with authors and artists and librarians about books, ideas, and books about books. We're here today with Mark Michael Epstein, professor of religion at Vassar College, to talk about his new book, The Medieval Haggadah, Art, Narrative, and Religious Imagination, published by Yale in 2011?
Correct. Yes. Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're pleased and honored you could join us. So, just to start things off, can you describe your book and tell us what it's about?
Well, for about 2,000 years now, Jews have been celebrating the Passover holiday with a home service. It's more than a service. It is a performance, I would say, recounting and recalling and putting oneself in the shoes of those who made the exodus from Egypt, who fled the service of Egypt's pharaoh to the service of Sinai's God. And in doing so, they have used a text as their guide, but not specifically as their script, and that text is called the Haggadah, the telling. Mm-hmm. People sit around tables, people speak late into the night, there are ritual foods that are consumed and real foods that are consumed, and the story is recounted. In the Middle Ages, there developed a tradition of illuminating books that were used for this home service of the Eve of Passover. And I'm looking at four signal examples, examples concerning which it had been said all the scholarship was finished and done, right? That was one of my criteria for choosing these books, books which were essentially closed books because they had been quote-unquote solved or left unsolved. I thought maybe they needed a closer look and a second glance, which is always my policy in looking at illuminated manuscripts.
So, you know, I have to say, this is a remarkable book on a number of levels, as a groundbreaking work of scholarship, as a beautifully produced book, and as a work of insight generally into the artistic practices of the Middle Ages. And your reviewer in the TLS described your reading of large human concerns and images as reminiscent of the humanity, learning, and perception that characterized the work of Meyer Shapiro, which is no small praise.
Wow.
Personally, as someone who spent a lot of time poring over image cycles and manuscripts, I had the same excited reaction while reading your book. These are holistic readings, as you say. One might call them phenomenological, even. They're readings based on close looking, certainly. They're informed, certainly, by art historical and doctrinal learning and learning in general. But they're not blinded by either, which, unfortunately, is, in my experience, very often the case. And so, you know, my question is your scholarship informed here by your teaching and work with students? And I ask this because students also tend to approach things with fresh eyes in the classroom.
That's an excellent question. My answer is yes, yes, unequivocally yes. Not only students in the classroom, but people in the synagogue, people on the street, people in life.
Yeah, and your son.
And yes. my son and my daughter, and now my other sons. Yeah, I mean, so. The process of looking at these images, to which we are somewhat inured, because after all, here is Moses in his basket, and here is the Pharaoh afflicted with plagues, and here is Miriam dancing on the shores of the Red Sea. We've seen all this before. We know it. It's sort of inherent in our consciousness, in our blood, in our culture.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. These are familiar, and almost anyone familiar with Western culture can read them and understand what they're looking
right,
at.
Right, right. So what is needed is, as you say, fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. And I find myself continuously astounded, even after 21 years of teaching, by the insights to which students bring, particularly with regard to details. I can have been looking at an image for a decade, and somebody says something that blasts me out of the water, and of course deserves credit, and I do credit my students in all my work, but opens my eyes onto a sort of new vista, and this occurs all the time. So it's really, I would say that my work is dialectic with that of my students to the nth degree, to such an extent, I would add, that my abhorrence of the idea of closedness in scholarship leads me actually in the conclusion of the book help to invite students and colleagues and anyone else to come and respond to this and develop it to the next stage. Someone wrote me an email and said how happy she was that I had definitively solved the problems of the birds' heads. And I said, I've only solved it until you come and solve it again. That's why the book has so many illustrations. That's why the book is replete with complete reproductions of all the narrative sequences in full color and in full size. It was difficult to get this done. To their credit, Yale University Press was very receptive. Mm-hmm. But that was the idea, that you, Tom, should be able to look through this sequence and check my results and offer your own.
Interesting, because it is unusual to have every item and every work that you're looking at reproduced in full color and then details taken out of it and reproduced again to support the argument. And when you look at other works on medieval Haggadah, they're usually in black and white.
They usually show you only what the art historian in question wants to show you. Yeah. And I don't want to hold my cards so close to my chest. I wanted to open up the conversation, and that was the intention of this book. Yale, to its credit, and the editor, Michelle Comey, exceptionally receptive to this idea. It is, I feel, very important to let people judge for themselves the quality, the logic, the way an argument holds together. And I think that putting it in the reader's hands is at the middle, is at the center, I should say, of the enterprise.
So can you talk more specifically about how these works might have been used in the Passover service? Because they're not quite liturgical works in the way Christian breviaries and lectionaries, say, are, and the service books that were used in the Mass and other formal services, are they?
Right. The Passover ceremony, or Seder, really the word is order, of the evening of Passover is quite a Gesamtkunstwerk, in the sense that, you know, we speak about opera, right? Opera is a Gesamtkunstwerk because it brings in costume and music and song and dance, perhaps, and puts it all together. The Seder night is a night where you have a multi-generational crowd. You have them sitting around a table. You have them attempting to relate their own experience to something that they never experienced, but have to, by dint of the commandment, experience. That is, the fact that in each and every generation, everyone must see him or herself as if he or she had personally come out of Egypt. And the words to see, leharot, in the Mishnah, the primary text for this commandment, is interestingly couched in visual language. Maimonides, a Spanish medieval interpreter of law, among other things, is very interested in this word, and he reads it differently. He says, leharot, to display oneself. So there's a performative aspect, and there's a narrative aspect. It's somewhere between liturgical plays performed in the marketplace and the drama of a high mass, right? It's solemn but open. It's adventurous and funny. Sometimes it's comic. It is very, very personal. It is performative. In the medieval Sephardic, that is the context of those lands that now are in the domain of Spain, I'd say in Portugal and North Africa context, Jews would literally perform. The smallest children would come in, put a basket of unleavened bread on their head, and they were asked, where are they coming from? Egypt. Where are they going to? The promised land, right? So, you know, there was a whole performative aspect. So looking at these pages in gold illumination and color over the shoulder of the person who was orchestrating this performance was part of the phenomenon.
And it is part of what might be called a memory practice, the sort of work that ritual often performs for us to cultivate and preserve identity as well as cultural memory.
Tell the story again in a way that inserted oneself into it.
Yeah, interesting. Our conception of the Middle Ages has been changing over the past decades, thanks to scholars who no longer approach the period as a period of darkness, you know, the Dark Ages that falls between the Renaissance and the Classical Age, nor is it regarded as a monolithic period where everyone adhered to the same straightforward set of social, political, and religious beliefs and customs defined around feudalism and church doctrine, the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. So your book fits in many ways, doesn't it, to what is sometimes called the New Medievalism?
That's high praise, but it's accurate. I would say that the New Medievalism is characterized by a focus on otherness, on minority, on relationship between the larger picture of the cathedral, the cloister, and the court, juxtaposed with the world of people who were on the margins of those worlds, but also were integrally integrated in some ways. You know, if you look at the commentaries of Hugh and Richard of St. Victor, you will find that very often they contain within them references to the Jews. Hebrei dikunt, Judei dikunt, Rabbi Salomonis dikit. You know, the Jews say, the Hebrews say, Rabbi Solomon, that is, Rashi, the great Jewish exegete who lived in Troyes at this time, says. And you can imagine the canons of St. Victor meeting with the yeshiva students on their way up or down the hill, mm-hmm. and saying, we just studied this passage in Exodus. What does Rabbi Solomon say about it, right? So it's not necessarily that our picture changes, that the cathedral, the cloister, and the court are any less important, but we realize that they didn't exist in a vacuum, and they existed in relationship with the others who shared their space, mm-hmm. Jews, as the largest demographic minority in the Western Middle Ages, some Muslims, certainly the role of women is being interrogated. I often say, to the shock of my interlocutors, and Tom, nothing shocks you, so it shouldn't be a problem here, that I'm not interested in art. Mm-hmm. I'm actually interested in people. Mm-hmm. And my approach to art is an approach that attempts to get me as close as I can, and there are grave problems with this, to the people for whom it was created, and equally importantly, the people who viewed it over many generations. Mm-hmm. So I think my work fits in the new medievalism in its own sort of humble way.
Yeah, interesting. So you look at images as vehicles of interpretation and as texts of a kind in themselves, don't you?
Yes.
And these interpretations sometimes run against the grain of, well, not merely of our historical interpretation, but of doctrinal interpretation,
yes.
of Scripture,
yes.
Which is interesting. And they're very inventive sometimes, I
right.
think. So you mentioned that the exegetical work or the interpretive work that these images do is part of what you call the inner life of a manuscript.
Right.
And I wonder if you could explain
what right.
you mean by that.
That's a term.
I fastened right on it.
Right, well, it's good. It's a term I invented and because I had no other suitable language. Let me say that, of course, the doctrinal bases of Jewish visual culture in the Middle Ages often stand in relationship, and this is very important, mm-hmm. I've changed my thoughts on this, either in polemic opposition to, or in a sort of companionable relationship mm-hmm. with Christian doctrine on similar subjects. Mm-hmm. But Jewish interpretation, whether in textual or visual context, can be sort of counter-scriptural, but it can never be counter-doctrinal,
yes.
since the doctrine in Judaism tends to expand infinitely,
yes.
and incorporate within it whatever is being discussed. Mm-hmm. Having said that, one can notice that manuscripts that employ a similar, quote-unquote, conventional iconography, and I'm interested in these because, again, it's the familiar picture of Moses in his basket.
Yeah.
What after all, can be said, yeah. can have very different tenor and tone. Now, what's fascinating about these manuscripts is that they are all orphans. Mm-hmm. We have no provenance information about them whatsoever. We can determine on the basis of their style and their mode of illustration basically where and when they were created, mm-hmm. but we don't know anything about the authorial constellation, the people who commissioned and illuminated them, put them together, whether they were Jews or Christians, mm-hmm. what their politics were like. We know they were wealthy. That's clear, and that's very important, as I'll discuss. But I essentially have to do the very, what's regarded in art historical circles, is a very dangerous work of reverse engineering, mm-hmm. to look at the iconography of two manuscripts that seem similar, mm-hmm. or nearly identical, and in the interstices between the words nearly and identical, determine what their, to use the French term, difference, mm-hmm. might be, you know, and to say the inner life of this manuscript is considerably more angry, is considerably more polemic than this other manuscript, which looks similar but is more mm-hmm. quietistic and more conciliatory.
Mm-hmm.
So by inner life, I mean the tenor and tone of the manuscript as determined by its iconography.
Oh, interesting. With many approaches to medieval material, text as well as images, a narrative linearity in an attempt to read everything as though it were sort of novel, with one thing happening after the next,
right.
and at the end there's some sort of
denouement,
yeah, and moral to be derived from the whole thing.
Right.
But you don't limit yourself to narrative interpretation or
right.
linear interpretation.
Right. Many a moon ago, mm-hmm. It was determine that in the Middle Ages, the prevailing way of reading is anagogical or allegorical, yeah. or Cynthia Hahn talks mm-hmm. about reading manuscripts out of sequence in yeah. order to make points in catechizing yes, yeah. proselytes and things like mm-hmm. that. But of course, everybody knows that the Jews are literalists. They are, when glasses, when spectacles appear in Western art, they appear first on the eyes of the Jews, because the Jews are always looking deeply into the text, so deeply that they don't realize that Christ has come and grace has suffused the world mm-hmm. and we're living in a different environment. Mm-hmm. So of course, Jewish art must be narrative and linear. This is a prejudice that appends to even Jewish historians mm-hmm. of Jewish art. And I wanted to think more of this as part of the wider medieval phenomenon of how we look at text. Look, the fact is that Jews regarded scripture as a love letter from God. Mm-hmm. And if you received a letter from your lover, you would scrutinize it very closely to understand what metaphors, what desires, mm-hmm. what was expressed within it. And so it stands to reason that Jewish art should be as rich as Christian art mm-hmm. When it comes to thinking beyond linearity. So mm-hmm. that was the assumption that I went into this with, and the assumption that has carried and buoyed my work along as it has proceeded.
There is a tradition of allegorical exegesis in Jewish yes. Interpretation, yes. right? It goes back to Josephus.
That's true. Well, Philo, I think you're thinking
okay,
about.
That's right. Yeah, that's
right.
Right.
Philo, the man, not the dough. Yeah. Yeah. Jewish exegesis and Christian exegesis actually imitates it in this mm-hmm. sense.
That's
has four levels of scriptural mm-hmm. reading. Yeah. That is contextual or simple, allegorical, sermonic. Homiletic, mm-hmm. and then finally secret or mystical. And all those levels are present. Direct allegory drops out to a certain extent in the Middle Ages in response to Christianity's championing of that. Yeah. But you will still find Rashi, the exegete I mentioned, attempting to block the sexuality out of the Song of Songs by allegorical interpretation. Your two breasts, says the text, these are Moses and Aaron, says Rashi. Right? So, right?
Yeah. Can you tell us anything about how these manuscripts were made and commissioned? Can we surmise, say, anything about who was responsible for their coming into being?
Well, the question of who made the manuscripts, of course, is an important question. And it devolves, in a way, on socioeconomics. You may think that Frank Gehry is a brilliant architect, but if you commission a house from Frank Gehry, you don't say to him, Frank, ignore how many children I have, put as many children's bedrooms in the house as you want, right? You work closely with this architect on this very expensive project. So whoever actually put brush and pen to parchment on these manuscripts, whether Jew or Christian, worked under very close supervision of Jews. Mm-hmm. However, since these Jews were extremely wealthy, remember these manuscripts were very valuable yes. commodities, probably the equivalent of the cost of a Frank Gehry house today yes. to have one of these manuscripts in your home. Very few had them. They usually had one single manuscript in a whole household, as I can prove in the case of the Bird's Head Haggadah. Uh-huh. It's a very interesting story, but we'll get to that. The patrons were very concerned with how they looked. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to fit in stylistically with the wider society, which is why you look at the Golden Haggadah and you say, funny, you don't look Jewish, right? Meaning that this is Northern Italianate, Frenchy, Spanish style of the period. Yeah. So the negotiation was not only doctrinally, but stylistically. And these manuscripts were very au courant. They can hold their own with manuscripts in the wider culture, and what is Jewish about them is the way that they are conceptualized, the way they are organized, the way that their inner life manifests itself. Uh-huh. I would say the voice is the voice of Jacob. Okay. The inside is the Jewish voice, and the hands, the outer manifestations, are the hands of Esau, the older brother, the Christian society.
How did these commissions help their owners negotiate between fitting into the wider medieval culture while at the same time allow them to maintain their distinct identity?
Well, they presented themselves as people who owned books, just like Christians owned Books of Hours, right, contemplation. Yeah. They were wealthy householders who belonged to the upper crust of society, who had beautifully illuminated books. Mm-hmm. But what was in the books was, of course, indigenously Jewish. Jews were a population in the Middle Ages that were occasionally envied, sometimes despised and persecuted, usually misunderstood. And my view of Jews and Christians in medieval society has changed considerably. In my first book, Dreams of Subversion in Medieval Jewish Art and Literature, I saw it as a polemic interaction wherein Christians owned the art and the iconography, and Jews were sort of scrambling around the back, grabbing through guerrilla tactics pieces of it and reinterpreting it in a way that dissed Christianity.
Yes, yeah.
This book is much different. I see it as more of a mutual fishing expedition where there's a stream of culture flowing by Jews and Christians, and each are fishing in it, and sometimes they come up with the same thing, sometimes they come up with different things, but each filters it through its own religious consciousness.
Interesting. And then but there is some negotiation going on.
Sure. So that, for instance, Moses' flight into Egypt from Midian is troped exactly as the flight of the Holy Family into Egypt, because that is in the consciousness of the society. You know, everybody knows who Santa Claus is in America, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, doesn't matter what your religious background is. So these images, I believe, were widely diffused in society, and they were interpreted by the individual communities, each in its own way.
So, you know, if we could turn to each of your four manuscripts and talk about them a bit. First, in the book, The Bird's Head Haggadah, has caused many a scholar to scratch his head, and there have been many wild explanations of why certain figures in the text have bird-like features, and other figures in the text have no features on their faces at all. But you seem to have hit, you know, even though, as you say, it's not a definitive reading, perhaps, but you seem to have hit on what seems to me a very strong reading of the bird's heads.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us about it?
Sure. I mean, all credit really goes to Misha, my son, who's now 24, who was then about 10. You know, it's not exactly true that people notice the blank human faces. They noticed them but didn't make much of them. However, can one blame them? In a manuscript in which nearly every figure has the features of aquiline, sharp-beaked birds, it's hard to sort of notice anything else.
And these are like cartoon characters almost.
They're cartoony,
they're people with beards and dressed well, but they all have bird's heads.
That's basically. Right. It's like a costume party where everybody's wearing a bird head.
Yes.
And, you know, various, as you say, various theories had been advanced that these are relate to the animal-headed saints in Christianity, or that they are anti-Semitic caricatures, that in the words of Ruth Mellenkopf. Of course, anti-Semitism can apply to the Middle Ages. It's a racialist theory of the German 19th and obviously 20th century, wherein Jews and Arabs are Semites racially. Mm-hmm. So you would just say anti-Jewish. But even if they're anti-Jewish caricatures, the idea that somebody should commission a manuscript replete with so many grotesquely anti-Jewish caricatures
for themselves
and then maintain it for generations in a position of honor, save it from fire and flood and famine and makes the Jewish authorship or the Jewish patrons out to be as blind as Christians always supposed Jews to be in the Middle Ages, and I can't accept that. What I noticed was that there are blank-headed figures alongside the bird-headed figures, and both of these...
They have heads, but there are
no faces. In fact, to such an extent that someone slightly later, with slightly younger ink, maybe 200 or 300 years after the manuscript was completed, felt compelled to very lightly paint in faces on some of them because it was so weird and disconcerting. Well, I was perusing the manuscript with Misha, who was then 10 years old, and he was nonplussed by the bird-headed figures in the manuscript, but he was compelled by the blank face figures, and he came up with a theory that distinguished between Jews and non-Jews on the basis of these heads or headlessness. And what I noticed also, as others have, is that the bird-headed figures are not simply bird-headed. They are, as you note, bearded, many of them, and eared.
Yes.
And so they are griffin heads, actually. And the griffin, while one doesn't tend to think of it as an ancient Jewish symbol, is in fact the most ancient Jewish symbol, since the cherubs on the Ark of the Covenant, which we nowadays, through the interventions of the Renaissance, regard as chubby, cute putti, were actually, according to the biblical description, had leonine and aquiline characteristics. And this description was sort of Actually, the Bible only describes them with wings, but the Talmud describes them as having leonine, aquiline, and human characteristics. And so I refer to this as the cherubic topos, that these birds, bird-headed figures, refer to the combination of lion and eagle found in the holiest of ancient Israelite places, and refer both to the spirit, and that is the eagle, and the physical phenomenon of Jews. Moreover, in the very community in which this manuscript was created, probably Mainz, but certainly in the Rhineland region, when the Crusaders came through and the Jews martyred themselves in the face of the Crusaders in their numbers, after this had all occurred, memorial prayers were written after 1096, which would certainly have been known in 1300 when the Bird's Head Haggadah was created, which referred to the denizens of Mainz as stronger than lions and swifter than eagles. So it seems to me that it's a very strong possibility that this has to do with identity.
Yes.
And so even among the bird's headed figures, there are a variety of different types, fully enfranchised members of the community who are fully incorporated in all ways and indicated visually as such, and members of the community whose allegiance or status is questionable in one way or another. And this reflects, as you'll see in the book, a variety of socio-religious strata among the Jewish community of the High Middle Ages in the Southern Rhineland Valley. It's delightful. You have to see it.
Yeah, you do. You really do have to see it. Moving on then to the Golden Haggadah, it's from a different environment. It's not from men's. This is a work from Spain, yes.
Right.
Can you talk about it and perhaps also about the female figures in the work, which I found interesting?
This is one of several Haggadot that appear in Spain in the 1320s through 1350s, including the very famous Sarajevo Haggadah, about which a novel was written, but a number of others that have a sequence of narratives beginning with Genesis and continuing through the Exodus before the text of the Haggadah. What's interesting about this one is that almost 50 distinct images of women, and women where they don't need to be in the narrative, appear, which sort of alerted me to possibilities for reading the manuscript through the eyes of perhaps a woman patron. And what one notices in and among these images of women are many images of women who have lost children. From Rachel, who has lost Joseph, who appears almost resurrected or out of place in a scene where she shouldn't appear, right very centrally mourning for Joseph, to an Egyptian woman with a dead baby after the plague of the firstborn lying pietà-like on her lap. And then many images of women with children restored to them, so that when the Israelites leave Egypt and cross the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea, the first figures are women with children on their shoulders, not Moses with his staff. And finally, culminating in a scene in which a woman with six children and a small infant in her arm, making seven, receive Passover accoutrement from the head of the household, evoking this idea of preternatural fertility. And so my thesis about this is that the manuscript was commissioned for a woman, and perhaps for a woman who had lost a child. Now, there is a lot of flap about this, particularly around Israeli scholars, by Israeli scholars, who are interested in my quote-unquote proving this. The way they think I should prove this is to discuss, quote-unquote, the status of women in Barcelona in 1320. And I do that in the notes. I don't spend a chapter doing it in the book. I direct the reader to other authors who have written on this subject in much more depth than I could possibly write, but I will submit the following. Even if we determine that the status of women in Barcelona in 1320, Jewish women, was insufficient for husbands to commission manuscripts on the part of wives, or wives were not wealthy enough or autonomous enough to commission manuscripts for themselves, I submit to you, what would prevent a single exceptional woman or a single exceptional husband from doing this? So all the historical proof that I could bring would be for naught if this manuscript was an exception, which, well, it might have been. This is a problem in general. Art historians tend to think that by overburdening the reader with contextual history, they somehow solve any individual manuscript. But of course, any individual manuscript is a unique phenomenon also, born of particular circumstances.
Yes, yes.
So. It's a beautiful manuscript.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yes, I'd love to own that one. I considered taking it out of the British Library, but I have reader privileges, but obviously not borrower privileges. Yeah. What can I say?
The last two manuscripts, which are related, the Rylands and its brother manuscript, you really did some interesting reading there. I thought, is one merely a copy of the other?
Right.
And I'm not sure about this, but was the Rylands just at the Met?
Yes, it was. There was a wonderful, there's a wonderful exhibition which pairs Jewish manuscripts with the general medieval collection, so you can see these things in context. And I spoke about the Rylands at the Met. There's an online video of it, but just to summarize, the Rylands, the brother Haggadah in the British Library, the one that stayed at home in England and didn't travel, is a very sort of gentle and almost quietistic, elegant, pastoral narrative, presents narrative. The Rylands Haggadah exhibits particular anger. And while the configurations of the scenes and the placement of the figures is very, very similar. For instance, in the plagues, you know, the brother Haggadah suffices us with four or five little frogs for the plague of frogs. But in the Rylands Haggadah, there's frogs everywhere, right? Pharaoh is grimacing hideously, right? Yeah. There's this idea, there's this feeling of vengefulness, as if the brother Haggadah, which came first, was insufficiently hard on those damn Egyptians. And one can imagine someone sitting in Spain in the 1340s, looking at a model and saying, you know, the way you're depicting the hierarchy, right, is not my experience with the hierarchy. I have much bitterer experience, and I would like Pharaoh to suffer just a little more.
Interesting. Right? Yeah, it's interesting that because they are so similar, then the differences are more apparent when you
the late Professor Nikes, who said that they were nearly identical. It's the nearly that's the problem, of course.
I think we're burdened sometimes by notions that come from print, that one copy is basically just a copy. It's,
you know, right.
It's,
but my wife, who is a twin, would tell you otherwise.
Yes. Oh. Right. So I tend to like to ask this question to scholars I have on the show because we're about, to a great extent, research in libraries. Can you talk about the libraries that you worked in?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this book took a lot to produce, but not because of the libraries. Mm-hmm. The libraries were phenomenal. I mean, the librarians and the curators, Ilana Tahan at the British Library, Anna Nitsa at the Israel Museum, Anne Young at the John Rylands Library, were extraordinarily generous with their time. They take an obvious pride and delight in the treasure trove of beautiful volumes in their expert care. They made me feel immediately at home among colleagues. You know, I don't know, there may be scholars who regard library people as service people, you know, but to me, librarians are colleagues who love these books as much as I do, and very often we'd sit together and look at the books and point things out to each other. So I'm so grateful for their reception and their generosity with their time and with their materials. I mean, I've sat and pored for hours in each of those libraries over each of these books under the expert care and guidance of people who really are deserving of their role as custodians. Yeah. Extraordinary, extraordinary experience.
Yeah. And the Bird's Head Haggadah, that is in Jerusalem?
Right.
And which library was
that? That's in the Israel Museum. It's in the museum, but the curator there, Anna Nitsa, took it off display for me. We looked at it in her office. Yeah. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And she's a very insightful person, too, as is Ilana Tahan at the British Library. So when I say I work closely with these people, I listen to them as well as looked at the books.
Yeah, Jerusalem and Tel Aviv both have wonderful libraries. There's the center of the book, I know.
Yes, in Tel Aviv is wonderful, and Jerusalem has the National Library, which is fabulous. And I've been very lucky and very privileged to be able to receive the grants to travel to these places and to spend the time there. So
And this was a long labor for you, this book, right? I mean, does this come out of your dissertation?
No, not at all. My first book came out of my dissertation, which was Dreams of Subversion in Medieval Jewish Art and Literature. That was published by Penn State University Press in 1992. And since then, I've been working on the ideas that have come into this book. So it was really a decade in preparation, but a total labor of love. I must say...
It seems as though it is when you look at it.
Sweet, but I've never had a day working on this where I felt discouraged or that I didn't want to continue with the work. It's just such a delight to be able to, you know, my tradition, because I'm an observant Jew myself, I've studied the Talmud, and the Talmud is like an experience where you sit in the room with many people from many different generations, and you argue fine points and large points of the text, and you gain insight, hearing the voices of people who have gone before as if they are right there and present with you. The same experience appends to looking at these manuscripts. It has been such a pleasure and delight. Those 10 years flew by so quickly, I became gray and bald and fat, and I had no idea that they'd gone, but they were a pleasure.
Yeah, well, you're finding meaning all the time, and that's always exciting, isn't it?
I'm trying to find meaning, I must say.
So can you talk about future projects? I know for a fact that there are lots of manuscripts out there that could benefit from this sort of treatment. I mean, if not from you directly, possibly in the future from your students people that pick up on or on your methodology. So what are you up to?
Well, it's an interesting question. I have two book projects now in press being considered. One is called Skies of Parchment, Seas of Ink, Jewish Manuscript Illumination, and that is an edited volume that the work on which started some 40 years ago, and it passed from hands through the hands of editor to editor, each of whom thought that she or he could write the book on Jewish manuscript illumination, until it came to me, who is acutely aware of his limitations and realized that to write the book on Jewish manuscript illumination, it might be good to get a team of people together. And so this is an edited volume. It has some 300 full color illustrations. It will be the first survey of Jewish manuscript illumination in the medieval and early modern period, including manuscript after printing, including manuscripts from Persia and the East, that has been attempted since, since the 70s. That's a very exciting project, which is now in press.
A lot of work.
A lot of work and a lot of corralling cats, getting people together. Yeah. But the people are wonderful, and the contributions are smart and up to date and thoughtful, and I'm very excited to see that come out. And I have another project, which is called Extremities, Mapping the Margins of Jewish Art. And this is, how can I say it? This is a riff on the work of the late, great, and sorely missed Michael Camille and his work in Image on the Edge. And what I am trying to think about is the margins of a marginal culture, not only in manuscripts, but societally as well. And so I'm interested in such diverse phenomena as the way in which the literal margins of the medieval page work differently in Jewish manuscripts than they might in Christian manuscripts. I'm interested in the way in which Jews in cultures in which they were marginalized presented themselves as being inherent parts of that culture. So I look at a Seder ensemble, that is, physical objects created for the Seder by a fellow named Solomon Guggenheim at the beginning of the last century in Germany, and the fate of those objects and the way those objects tried to create a German Gothic, a German neo-Gothic, but a German Jewish neo-Gothic.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's a very, very interesting phenomenon, what happened to those things. And there are other stops along the way, including the reconfiguration of manuscripts, I believe, by a very important Hungarian collector, in which he restored, quote-unquote, Jewish manuscripts in the Middle Ages. But I think he reconformed them to enhance the role of women, to conform to his particular reformist tendencies in religion. So that's sort of bringing women from the margins to the center. And then finally, I look at contemporary Haredi, that's ultra-Orthodox art. And yes, those people with the fuzzy hats and the long side curls do make art. It's, for the most part, egregious and kitschy, just in the way that Werner Salmon's Christian art is for Protestants. But it's really, really interesting in that, for instance, you know, it's somewhat startling to find a Haggadah produced for this community and printed and widely diffused in which very, very few women appear, right? Because in those societies, women are out of public view. It's not that they don't have a strong role. I come from them, so I understand that they do have a strong role, but they are not represented. So that's not so surprising. But to open up the Book of Esther, in which the protagonist who saves her people from a genocidal onslaught and for whom the book is named is central, you will agree, in the biblical narrative. And to find that in this 21st century rendering for a Haredi community, Esther barely appears. She appears as a hand in one or two illustrations, and the back of the head in another, is somewhat startling, but more startling when we realize that there's an extra-biblical character, a non-biblical character, the daughter of the evil protagonist, Haman, who does appear full face. And we have to ask then the question of what is a woman? And when do you take a central woman and marginalize her? And when do you take a woman distinctly on the periphery and centralize her? And for what reason? So I'm very interested in, well, I'm an edgy guy, right? So I'm interested in edges.
And that's
the project on which I'm currently working and which I will be currently researching, and from which the book Extremities, Mapping the Margins of Jewish Art, will hopefully be born.
So I want to thank you, Mark, for visiting with us in the Library Cafe and talking about your wonderful book, The Medieval Haggadah, Art, Narrative, and Religious Imagination, published by Yale University Press.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure. This is a great show, and I'm just very pleased, delighted to be able to talk with you this morning about this work.
Well, thank you.
I finally want to mention that there is a wealth of Hebrew medieval illuminated manuscripts now on view at the Jewish Museum on Fifth Avenue at 92nd Street in New York. The exhibit is called Crossing Borders, and it features a superb selection of over 50 Hebrew, Latin, and Arabic manuscripts on loan from the Bodleian Library at Oxford, and that'll be on view through February 3rd.